sugar. When I was on jury duty and on vacation, my blood sugar went way up, even though I was eating the same way. Now I know that I have to exercise. How much do you walk each day? I asked. It depends on what's happening at work. If we have notes calls, I get lots of treadmill time. Some days I walk more than 7 miles. Plus, work is more satisfying when I'm getting exercise accomplished at the same time. There's something about the treadmill that makes you feel, I'm up for this challenge, I'm striding towards success. Instead of feeling like I'm under an avalanche, I feel in control. And it's easy to get yourself to do it? I asked. Once it's your desk, it's your desk. It's not a hard habit to keep. I'm the fussy one. Identity. One regrets the loss even of one's worst habits. Perhaps one regrets them the most. They are such an essential part of one's personality. Oscar Wilde, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Just as I'd been slow to grasp the importance of the strategy of clarity, I'd been studying habits a long time before I began to appreciate the importance of identity. My idea of this is the kind of person I am is so bound up in my habits and actions that it's hard for me to see. But eventually, I realized that my sense of identity makes it easier or harder to change a habit. My friend Maria helped me understand the power of identity. I knew Maria because her son had been in Eliza's kindergarten class. She had a cheerful energy and an air of mischief that made me want to get to know her better. And in fact, a few years later, we started working together to make the videos for my blog. One day, after we'd finished making the latest set of videos, we started talking about habits. Purely by coincidence, of course. Any habits that you'd like to change, I proposed. Want to be a habits guinea pig for my notions? As a matter of fact, I'd like to cut back on my drinking, Maria said. I enjoy drinking, especially wine, but I pay the next day. Even if I've just had a glass of wine or two, I don't feel great. Also, normally I have crystal clear recollections of conversations, but when I drink, it's hazier. Last week I had a great conversation with my brother at dinner, and we were really connecting. But when I try to remember exactly what we both said, I can't. Plus, she added, I have this feeling that if I nailed this down, other things would be easier. Exercise, food, things like that. True, I said. As an abstainer, I felt obligated to point out the abstainer option, but Maria wasn't interested. No, she shook her head. I don't want to give up alcohol. The thing is, I'm Italian. I love great food and wine. I want to enjoy myself. And I think people expect it of me. I have a friend who says, are you having a glass of wine? Okay, I will too. People expect that I'll always be tons of fun. You are always tons of fun, I said. You know you are. Yes, she admitted with a laugh. I am tons of fun. Also, people will probably hardly notice how much you're drinking, unless they're using you to pace themselves. Like, oh, Maria's having another glass of wine, so I can too. Research shows that people eat and drink more or less, depending on what the people around them do. And you want to do what's right for you. I do love to have a great time, she said, but all that drinking isn't making me feel good. So you need to figure out how much and when you want to drink. After considering different scenarios, Maria decided on the habits she wanted to adopt. She wouldn't drink wine with dinner at home. For an ordinary dinner at a restaurant with friends, she'd limit herself to one glass of wine. For special celebrations, she'd allow herself several glasses. Maria and I emailed back and forth about her attempts to form a new habit, and at first, I mostly focused on Maria's rules for herself, when and how much she'd drink. We upholders always want to know the rules. We also discussed whether she could come up with a substitute drink, something festive but non-alcoholic. Maria invented a family drink of sparkling water with pomegranate juice and lime to drink with her husband Tom, who was also trying to cut down. I love the idea of a family drink for the end-of-day drink ritual. Over time, however, it became clear that for Maria, her sense of identity was a far more significant obstacle than sticking to the rules. Even though Maria had highlighted this issue during our very first conversation, I hadn't realized its significance. Her identity as an Italian, as someone who loves good meals, as the fun one, was her real challenge. She wrote in an email, "I feel like I am denying my personality, an Italian enjoying cooking and wine. I don't miss the taste. I do miss the celebratory feeling and the relaxation that accompanies a glass of wine. However, I do feel better not having that random drink or two on weeknights at home. Last night, I had to convince Tom not to open a bottle of wine because I knew I would want one. He agreed. I do have satisfaction that I am in control." Identity exerts a powerful force over our habits. When I told a friend about my low-carb eating, she shook her head and said, "That would never work for me. I don't want to be the fussy one, the one who says, 'I don't eat this,' or 'I don't do that.'" "You could make exceptions," I said, "like if you're a guest at someone's house." "Is that what you do?" she asked. "No," I acknowledged. "I stick to it. I don't care if people think I'm fussy. I am fussy. Also," I added, "I worried about my weight for so many years, it's worth it to me to be fussy, not to have to worry about it anymore." "Not me. I'm the girl who eats anything." It's only a problem if that non-fussy identity conflicts with something else, like eating in a different way. It's not hard for me because I get a big kick out of telling people, "I'm one of those low-carb fanatics you read about." Now that I'd identified it, I began to see the role of identity in many habit-related situations. "My husband and I desperately need to go to bed earlier," a friend told me. "We stay up too late, and we have to get up early because of the baby. We're exhausted. We keep saying we're going to go to bed earlier, and we never do." "What's your routine?" I asked. "At about 11, we go into the kitchen, have some nuts or cheese or something, and talk." "That sounds nice," I said. "Yes," she said. Then she added what sounded like the key to the issue. "We know we should be responsible parents and go to sleep, but we're holding on to this last piece of our adult lives before the baby. It just feels so domesticated to go to bed before midnight, even though we really need the sleep." The fact is, changing a habit is much more challenging if that new habit means altering or losing an aspect of ourselves. I regret the loss of even the most trivial identity-defining habits. For instance, for years, I didn't own a purse. I liked being the kind of woman who doesn't own a purse, and I delayed buying a purse, even though in many situations, carrying a purse would have been far more convenient than lugging my backpack around. Relinquishing this part of myself caused me a pang, even though it was such a tiny part of my identity. Research shows that we tend to believe what we hear ourselves say, and the way we describe ourselves influences our view of our identity, and from there, our habits. If I say, "I'm lazy," or "I can't resist a sale," or "I'll try anything once," or "I never start work until the last minute," or "I'm lucky," those ideas become part of my identity, which in turn influences my actions. Often, too, we can describe the same attribute in either positive or negative terms, which can help us shape the habits we want. Am I conscientious or rigid? Spontaneous or impulsive? Gourmet or glutton? Fun-loving or slacker? Artistic or disorganized? Energetic or restless? For years, I thought of myself as someone who hates exercise, but at some point I realized that I hate sports. I'm spectacularly uncoordinated, I don't like games, and I don't find competition fun. But I don't mind exercise, running, cardio machines, weight training. Thinking of myself as someone who enjoys exercise allowed me to change the way I viewed my nature, and that helped me to become a regular exerciser. In one study, one group of registered voters was asked, how important is it to you to vote? While another group was asked, how important is it to you to be a voter? The second group was more likely to vote in the next election because voting had been cast as an expression of identity. This is the kind of person I am, not just a task to be done. It can be thrilling to add a new element to our identity. I loved becoming a New Yorker, a parent, a blogger, a driver, and a happiness expert. Novelist Haruki Murakami, an avid long-distance runner, wrote about this process. Running an ultramarathon should add a few new elements to your inventory in understanding who you are. And as a result, your view of your life, its colors and shape, should be transformed. More or less, for better or for worse, this happened to me, and I was transformed. Identity can help us live up to our own values. I'm not someone who wastes time at work, or I'm no shirker, or if I say I'll show up, I show up. Of course, it's important to follow through on the habits that relate to our sense of identity, as opposed to letting the identity substitute for the habits. Watching CNBC doesn't mean I'm making smart choices with my retirement account. Wearing running shoes isn't the same as running. Buying vegetables isn't the same as eating vegetables. Reading Outside Magazine doesn't mean I go camping. Writing about happiness won't make me happier unless I stick to my happiness resolutions. I had dinner with a friend who told me, I've stopped eating sugar, but that chocolate mousse looks so delicious that I'm going to break my rules. When did you give up sugar? I asked. Last week, he said. He'd only gone without sugar for a few days, but in his mind, he was now a person who never ate sugar. Sometimes telling others about a decision to alter an aspect of our identity can help us stick to our habits. Maria used the strategy of distinctions to realize that she does better when she makes public resolutions. She wrote in an email, I was at a meeting and two people drank red wine and two didn't, I being one of them. Of course, when I said no, there was a big, oh, why not? I actually wanted to explain what I'm doing, and I also felt I had to prevent myself from changing my mind and deciding to have a glass after all. Once I made a statement about it, I felt I couldn't go back. Explaining reinforced the decision to say no. Sometimes we adopt a habit to signal the identity we want others to see. Artist David Sally told reporter Janet Malcolm, I had to train myself not to arrive exactly on the dot. It was absurd and unseemly to be so punctual. It was particularly unseemly for an artist to be so punctual. Less absurd, I wanted to ask, than for an artist to be deliberately unpunctual, to live up to other people's notions of how an artist should behave? Or we may adopt a habit to signal an identity we wish we had. A friend told me, I drank a little and smoked a little pot in high school, not because I wanted to, but because it was the quickest way to signal, I'm fun, I'm not a goody-goody, even though really I was. Companies and institutions can change our habits, for better and for worse, by persuading us to link certain habits to identities to which we aspire. In their invaluable book, Made to Stick, Chip and Dan Heath describe how an anti-littering campaign successfully changed the littering habits of Texans. After messages such as, please don't litter, and pitch in, failed with the target demographic. The typical litterer was a man, between the ages of 18 and 35, drove a pickup, and liked sports and country music. For the campaign, famous Texans such as George Foreman, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Willie Nelson, and various sports figures made TV spots with the message, don't mess with Texas. The campaign convinced viewers that a true Texan, a proud, loyal, tough, virile Texan, doesn't litter. During the campaign's first 5 years, visible roadside litter dropped 72%. Our habits reflect our identity. From what I've observed, the strategy of identity is particularly helpful for rebels. Rebels generally have a tough time accepting the constraints imposed by habits. But because they place great value on being true to themselves, they embrace a habit if they view it as an aspect of their identity. For instance, a rebel might want to be a respected leader. The identity of leader might help him to choose to keep habits, such as showing up on time or going to unnecessary meetings, that would otherwise chafe. He will choose to behave this way. A rebel wrote on my blog, "For me, the most important characteristic of a rebel is the freedom to be authentic to the person I am at this moment. My desires and needs shift, and I want the autonomy to pursue that. But I also have a strong sense of self, certain values and characteristics that define who I am and that don't change. For example, I've always defined myself as a great mother. I wasn't going to be the kind of mom that I had. I was going to be a dedicated mom who shows love. And I do." Another rebel noted, "If a habit is part of who I am, then that habit isn't a chain holding me to the ground. It's permitting me to be authentic to myself." We can get locked into identities that aren't good for us. A workaholic, a perfectionist, a southerner, the responsible one. As part of the strategies of the four tendencies and distinctions, I'd work to identify different personality categories to which I belonged, but those kinds of labels should help me understand myself more deeply, not limit my sense of identity. Someone wrote on my site, "Food and eating used to play a big part in my identity until I realized that my baking and being a baker was resulting in being overweight. So I had to let that identity go." A rebel friend clearly loves the idea of herself as the hard, partying fun girl, and when I overheard someone jokingly tell her, "You're not an adult," she repeated with delight, "Nope, I'm no adult." She likes the identity of being a non-adult, but that identity could become a problem. Anyone who identifies with the idea of youth as a wunderkind, as a prodigy, as a young Turk, as an ingenue, will eventually be forced out. When I began to think about my identity and my habits, I saw several instances in which my identity was getting in my way. I identify as a reader, and as part of that identity, I developed the habit of finishing every book I read, because a real reader finishes books, right? And I'm not alone. According to the book recommendation site Goodreads, 38% of readers always finish a book. I vowed to adopt the habit of putting down a book as soon as I lost interest. What a relief. When I let myself abandon a boring book, I have more time to read what I love, and I feel more energized and happy because I enjoy myself more. But I had another identity-related habit that required more internal debate. For months, I'd been trying to meditate, which had required me to change my identity, because for years, I'd identified as a person who resists meditation. But then I decided to try it. I'd stuck with it this far, but it was time to reconsider. My upholder tendency and habit inertia had pushed me to continue with meditation, but except for a few times when I'd felt better able to calm myself, it didn't seem to make any difference. For me, meditation was difficult and boring and seemingly fruitless. A bad mix. I decided to stop meditating. But once I made that decision, I discovered that I was reluctant to relinquish the new part of my identity. I was tempted to stick with meditation merely because I wanted to be a person who meditates, which is not the same thing at all as wanting to meditate. No, I would quit. It wasn't a good fit for me. I was sorry that I hadn't embraced it, but as always, I reminded myself to do what's right for me. Once again, I was a person who doesn't meditate. B. Gretchen. Not everyone is like me. Other people. Associate with people who are likely to improve you. Seneca. Letters from a Stoic. I'm a gold star junkie. I love praise, appreciation, and knowing that I've helped someone. For that reason, I love to hear about Elizabeth and her treadmill desk. Thinking about a good habit that I'd helped her to form gave me far more pleasure than thinking about my own new and improved habits, especially when she told me that the treadmill desk had allowed her to get better control of her blood sugar. And now it wasn't just the treadmill. She called with a further update. Listen, she said, I went to Inform Fitness. My beloved strength training gym had opened a branch in L.A. I'd forwarded the announcement email to Elizabeth, but she hadn't replied, so I figured she wasn't interested. Excellent, I said. What did you think? It's hard, but I see what you mean. 20 minutes once a week, how can I justify not doing it? Elizabeth gave me full credit, which delighted me, but Jamie wasn't as free about doling out the gold stars. We were getting dressed one morning when I saw him contemplating himself in the mirror. I've lost several pounds, he said. He didn't need to lose weight, but I'd noticed that he was looking leaner. Do you eat differently now that I eat low carb? I'd restrained myself from imposing my low carb philosophy on Jamie or my daughters, who continued to eat sweets, bread, potatoes, and the like, within reason. But admittedly, I did talk about it a lot. Sure, he said with a shrug. Really? You do? I was pleased to think that he'd been paying attention. How? Well, I don't really eat much bread anymore, he said as he pulled a gray suit off the hanger. On the weekends, I used to buy a quarter loaf of that raisin bread and eat it. Now I don't. I don't get bagels on the way to work. I don't eat as much granola. Is it because of the way I eat? Or because of the logic of eating low carb? Or you just don't want to anymore? A little of all of that, he said noncommittally. As usual, he wasn't very interested in plumbing the depths of his habits. Then, not long after this conversation, my mother-in-law mentioned that she and my father-in-law had also started to cut back on their carbs, partly because of me, partly because of the Tobbs book, partly because it seemed like a good idea. It's a secret of adulthood. I can't make people change, but when I change, others may change, and when others change, I may change. Up until now with my habits project, I'd focused on strategies that I use as an individual. Now I wanted to explore how people's habits interact in two directions. Other people's actions and habits exert tremendous influence on me, as mine do on them. First, I considered how other people affect my habits. I tend to think of myself as a separate actor, working on my habits on my own, but what others do, say, and think rubs off on me. For instance, in a phenomenon known as health concordance, couples' health habits and statuses tend to merge over time. One partner's health behaviors, habits related to sleep, eating, exercise, doctor visits, use of alcohol, cigarettes, and marijuana, influence those behaviors in a partner. If one partner has type 2 diabetes, the other partner faces a significant increase in the risk of developing it as well. If one partner gives up cigarettes or alcohol, the other is more likely to quit. As a reader wrote, I stopped drinking, and my husband has cut down a lot too, partly out of laziness, partly because social drinking isn't social anymore. Jamie's unwavering commitment to exercise has helped me stay dedicated. I also caught his habit of reading multiple books at one time, and buying books even when I have a huge pile I haven't read yet. Before we were married, I read one book at a time and never allowed myself to acquire more than 5 unread books. Also, some of my habits bothered Jamie so much that I gave them up. For some reason, he objected to my snacking in bed. Because we're quite susceptible to goal contagion, we may rapidly pick up someone else's habits, so it's helpful to be around people who are good role models. Other people can have a tremendous influence. In fact, I found that I'm more likely to be persuaded by seeing one person's successful action than by the most impressive research. It's a data point of one, But for me, that's a very persuasive data point. Once I thought about it, I was startled to realize how often I'd picked up a strong habit based on someone's passing remark. I saw a Twitter comment about Scrivener, the software program for writers, and now I use Scrivener every day. I read a short New York Times article that praised the Jawbone Up Band, and now I use it every day. I switched from eating roasted salted almonds to eating raw almonds after a friend told me, "Salt makes you hungry." I don't even know if that's true, but it changed my habit. In the book, The First 20 Minutes, Gretchen Reynolds notes, "I stand on one foot when I brush my teeth at night, which may be one of the most transformative actions I've picked up from researching this book. My balance and physical confidence have improved noticeably." I thought, well, I can do that. I decided to practice my balance when I rode up and down the elevator of our apartment building. Left foot on the way down, right foot up. Unfortunately, while people can be a good influence, they can also be a bad influence. By indulging in a behavior that we're trying to resist, they may tempt us to follow. Look at what he's doing. I want to do it too. Or we may want to avoid feeling out of step. Everyone's doing that. I don't want to be a wet blanket. Someone told me, "I try to keep to a strict budget, and the biggest challenge to that habit is the way my friends spend money. They buy a lot of unnecessary things, and then I start to behave like them unconsciously." In fact, people may actively undermine our efforts to change. Someone's new habit may make them feel abandoned, or jealous of the healthy habit and its consequences, or guilty in the face of someone else's efforts, or hurt if the habit makes them feel rejected or judged. Or maybe they're just annoyed by some minor inconvenience it creates. "I'd like to have the habit of exercising on weekend mornings," one friend said. "I tried it a few times, but my family complained. I wasn't there to make breakfast, to get everyone organized, all that. What do I do?" "Here's something I've noticed," I said. "If I do something only occasionally, people don't adjust. If I make a habit of something, they adapt." A friend had the same experience. "When I started shutting my office door for a few hours every morning, my coworkers learned to deal with it." The presence of other people can influence our habits in another way. When we're in a social situation, usually we want to fit in. This basic desire to be in step with others can become a stumbling block for good habits. As a friend explained, "I want to keep the atmosphere positive, for things to go smoothly. If I'm sitting across from someone at dinner, especially a client, I don't want to order an appetizer salad as my entree. Or if they order drinks, I feel like I should get a drink." "Do you think people actually notice?" I asked. "And if they notice, do they care? Would you care?" She hesitated. "I wouldn't care, but I think it does change things. Wouldn't it bother you?" "No, I don't really think about it," I told her. "I'm very susceptible to picking up habits from other people, but I must admit, whether it's because I don't mind violating these particular social norms, or because I don't have very good manners generally, I don't worry much about what people think of my eating and drinking habits. For a long time, I was baffled by other people's anxiety in this area, but eventually I realized that my attitude is more unusual than I'd thought. Before I started researching habits, I'd assumed that I was fairly average. In fact, I'd come to realize, I'm fairly freakish. Not everyone is like me. I'm an upholder and a total abstainer, of course. Also, as I discovered when I took the Newcastle Personality Assessor, which measures personality according to the Big Five model, openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, or OCEAN. For a woman, I score low on agreeableness, which measures a person's tendency to be compassionate and cooperative and to value getting along with others. I suspect that my low agreeableness partly accounts for my willingness to appear fussy or out of step in social situations. Also, in all modesty, my lack of concern stems from modesty. I just can't imagine that others are paying much attention to me. Surprisingly, Or perhaps not surprisingly, I found that the more matter-of-fact I am about my habits, the more readily people accept them, and me. This observation brought me to the next question. How do I affect other people's habits? I'm an odd mixture. In certain situations, I shrink from prodding people to do things they resist doing, perhaps to a fault. One of my parental duties is to nudge my daughters to develop habits or to try activities that they may not want to do, and I worry that I let them off the hook too easily. I tolerate Eliza's habit of leaving wet towels scattered around. Eleanor learned to ride a bike late because I didn't make her practice regularly. My daughters, and Jamie and I, don't have very good table manners because I don't enforce them. On the other hand, it's often hard for me to resist playing the expert or giving a lecture about habit change. I have to remind myself that I can't convince people. They must convince themselves, and the more I push, the more I may inflame opposition. Also, I remind myself, the approach that works for me may not work for someone else. For instance, Elizabeth embraced the treadmill desk, but she never did go back to a low-carb way of eating. I want to eat carbs sometimes, she told me, though I do eat healthfully at work always, and I never eat French fries. She found the approach that works for her. Given my know-it-all nature and my love for making suggestions, restraining myself from giving habit advice requires a lot of effort. It has proved much easier for me to give up sugar than to resist badgering people with advice about how to give up sugar. But I won't help anyone change a habit if I inspire a backlash of resistance. Knowing where a person falls in the four tendencies is enormously useful when I'm trying to suggest a habit. Most people are questioners or obligers, and for a questioner, an emphasis on reasoning, results, and logic is most persuasive. For obligers, forms of external accountability are the biggest help. With rebels, it's most useful to explain why a certain habit might be desirable, but make no attempt to encourage the rebel to try it. They must choose on their own. Also, I can help provide mental energy to support someone else's efforts. People fall into three gears when it comes to supporting, or opposing, other people's healthy habits. Drive. People in drive mode add energy and propulsive force to our habits. They can be very helpful as they encourage, remind, and join in. However, if they're too pushy, they may be a nuisance, and their enthusiasm can rouse a spirit of opposition. They may very well push a rebel away from a good habit. Reverse. Some people press others to reverse out of a healthy habit. They may do this from a sense of love, such as the food pushers who argue, "You should enjoy yourself," or "I baked this just for you." Or their behavior may be more mean-spirited as they try to tempt, ridicule, or discourage us from sticking to a healthy habit. Neutral. These folks go along with our habits. They support us whatever we do. Sometimes this is useful, but sometimes this support makes it easier to indulge in habits when we know we shouldn't. I asked if Maria thought anything I'd suggested had helped her with the habit of drinking less. I'd definitely been in drive mode with her. "Yes, it helped," she said. "You talked to me in a non-threatening way. You gave me ideas I could adjust. You followed up, and that helped. I'd think, I guess I'll have to tell Gretchen." "Do you think your habit has improved?" I asked. "For sure. Our conversations made me aware of what I was doing. In the past, I overdrank because I didn't think ahead or register what I was doing. I just said, 'Who cares? I want to have fun.' Now I drink more slowly and really savor it." In some cases, as with Maria, I did help people with their habits. In other cases, not so much. For example, I'd made a few trips back to Marshall's apartment to help him finish clearing his clutter, but our efforts didn't seem to make much difference to him, other than to make his apartment more pleasant. On my last visit, I said, "Wow, this place looks good." I wished I'd taken a before photo of Marshall's apartment so we could compare it to the after. "Yes," he said, "there's not much left to do." Let me ask you, I said, does this make any difference in your ability to work on your own writing projects? I gestured vaguely around his apartment. It would make a difference to me, but does it make a difference for you? He thought about it. Well, I don't think so. But that's because what I need to figure out is so much bigger, what to do with my life. I do like to be home more than I did, because there's not so much stuff. Also, now I have the habit of constantly getting rid of my clutter and things I don't need, which I think is very helpful to sanity generally. So that was good. Arguably, with some people, namely children, I might be able to enforce a behavior with enough consistency to make it catch hold as a habit. Eliza and Eleanor are the two people I most want to influence. I'd like to influence Jamie, but don't have the same sway over him. Countless habits shape family life. Do we recycle? Do we always show up on time? Or run a little late? Do we use curse words? Do we wear seat belts? Do we go to the doctor regularly? Do we kiss hello and goodbye? These kind of background habits have great influence over children and their assumptions about how the world works. Also, because people catch habits from each other, one important way to influence Eliza and Eleanor is for me to have good habits myself. If I want Eliza and Eleanor to be orderly, I should be orderly. If I don't want them to spend too much time staring into screens, I should turn off screens myself. As I considered the habits I wanted for my children, I vowed that I wouldn't press too hard. When adults pressure children to adopt certain habits, sometimes those habits stick, but other times there's a backlash. As a friend told me, when I was a child, my mother insisted that I hang up my clothes. Now I never hang up my clothes. With children and adults alike, when people are strongly warned not to do a particular thing, they often want to do it more than ever. The lure of the forbidden. When they get milder suggestions, they react with less resistance over the long run. One night, Eliza and I had a long conversation about homework. She lay on her bed while I prowled around the room in search of clutter to clear. I stashed bottles of blue nail polish, threw away empty gum wrappers, put books on the shelves, and put away clothes as we talked. I find light clutter clearing very relaxing. Eliza tolerated this activity. I just hate the feeling that my whole weekend is ruined by homework, she complained. I want time to hang out. But why is it worse on the weekend than during the week, I asked, as I put loose pencils into a pen cup. The work isn't such a big deal, she explained, but it seems like homework takes up the whole day. I thought about this. I knew the feeling of having a whole day consumed by 2 hours of work. Listen, I said, I have a crazy idea. I sat down next to her to emphasize the earnestness of my suggestion. How about this? I get up every day at 6 a.m. There are no distractions. I get so much work done. I love it. 6 o'clock is too early for you, but what if you got up at 7 on Saturday or Sunday? That's the time you usually get up, so it wouldn't be too hard. You can work in my office with me. I bet you'd get a lot done. Then the rest of your day would be freer. But I like to sleep late on the weekends, she said. You really love that, I know. It would be a pain to get up, but then your day would be so open, and you could still sleep late one morning. Well, maybe, Eliza said, much to my surprise. Really? I was excited to think she might try it. Great. I'll try it, she said. I'm not agreeing to do it forever. She agreed in theory, but when Sunday morning came, I wasn't sure what would happen when I knocked on her bedroom door at 7 o'clock. After some mumbling, she got up. And it worked. Now, on Sunday mornings, Eliza joins me in my little office. I do several things to help her maintain this habit. I make sure she's awake by 7. Once I forgot to wake her, and she slept until 7:45 and wailed, "I feel like the whole morning is gone." Before I wake her, I tidy my office so she has plenty of room. I turn on the space heater or the air conditioner. I bring her breakfast on a tray. Most important, though, I sit next to her and work myself. I'm a role model of industry, and I suspect she's less likely to jump to YouTube or Instagram if I'm sitting right there. This successful habit represents the combined strength of the strategies of scheduling, accountability, convenience, and other people. But I'm just one influence among many. Does Eliza get up early to work just because I suggested it? Doubtful. Is Eleanor neat because she sees me being neat? Or because I try to make her be neat? Or because she was born that way? I don't give myself too much credit or blame for my children's habits. Perhaps, like writing, leadership, and a sense of humor, good habits are something that must be learned, but can't be taught. The strategy of other people covers how others influence my habits and how I influence others' habits. I also hit on a quirky way to apply it to myself. In an odd but effective trick, I view myself from the outside. When I think of myself in the third person, many things become clearer. I hit on this technique after struggling to identify the right metaphor to describe the tension between my two selves, between now Gretchen and future Gretchen, between my want self and my should self. Jekyll and Hyde, the angel and devil on my shoulders, the charioteer driving two horses, the elephant and the rider, the ego, the id, and the superego, the spectator and the agent. In a flash, I saw that there's me, Gretchen, now Gretchen, want Gretchen, and there's my manager. I think I was inspired by Elizabeth's Hollywood workplace lingo. I imagine myself as the client, a fabulous celebrity, and like all fabulous celebrities, I have a manager. I'm lucky because my manager understands me completely, and she's always thinking about my long-term well-being. These days, when I struggle with a habit, I ask myself, what does my manager say? I was considering scheduling an hour a day to work on an ebook. I vacillated until I asked myself, what does my manager say? And my manager answered with a faint air of exasperation, Gretchen, you don't have time for that right now. It can be a relief to be told what to do. I agree with Andy Warhol, who remarked, when I think about what sort of person I would most like to have on a retainer, I think it would be a boss who could tell me what to do, because that makes everything easy when you're working. I'm the client, and my manager is the executive who works for me. Very appropriate, because my manager is my executive function. There's no need to rebel against my manager, because I am the boss of my manager. Not to mention, I am the manager. My manager reminds me to follow my good habits. Gretchen, you feel overwhelmed. Get a good night's sleep. You're tired, but you'll feel better if you go for a walk. She stands up for me when other people are too demanding. Just as the rock band Van Halen famously required bowls of M&Ms for backstage with all the brown candies removed, my manager says, Gretchen really feels the cold, so she can't be outside too long. Gretchen is writing her new book now, so she can't give a lengthy response to that email. On the other hand, she doesn't accept excuses like, this doesn't count, or everyone else is doing it. As an upholder, however, I've learned to be a bit wary of my manager. I know how she thinks. She's very impressed by credentials and legitimacy. She's sometimes so focused on my future that she forgets that I need to have a little fun right now. My manager is helpful, but in the end, I'm the one who must be Gretchen. I've been trying to help Jamie with his sleep habits because I've been listening to him complain every morning about how badly he'd slept, but one day he proposed a new habit himself. You have all those rules for me about sleep, he said one night. But we should have a habit to help us do something more important. I mean, sleep is important, but something more meaningful. Absolutely. What? I asked, delighted at the show of habit initiative from Jamie. I try not to expect him to join in my preoccupations. I realize how tiresome I can become. Let's set aside some time to talk each night, to tell each other about our day, really share what we're up to. I would love to do that. I was touched. For him to propose that we schedule a nightly sharing session was a real departure from his usual, let's not make everything too complicated approach. When? We need to be specific. How about after Eleanor goes to bed, he suggested. Now, most nights, I can't say we do this every night, we have a conversation about our days, and this small habit makes us feel more connected to each other. In the chaos of everyday life, it's easy to lose sight of what really matters, and I can use my habits to make sure that my life reflects my values. Everyday life in utopia. Conclusion. There is no more miserable human being than one in whom nothing is habitual but indecision, and for whom the lighting of every cigar, the drinking of every cup, the time of rising and going to bed every day, and the beginning of every bit of work are subjects of express, volitional deliberation. Full half the time of such a man goes to the deciding, or regretting, of matters which ought to be so ingrained in him as practically not to exist for his consciousness at all. William James, Psychology, Briefer Course. On our flight home from a family trip, a chatty flight attendant remarked, as I declined to take anything from the snack basket, after the holidays, a lot of people turn down the cookies and the pretzels. How long does that last? I asked. She smiled. About as long as most New Year's resolutions. I was intrigued by this real-world evidence of the failure of a yearly mass attempt at habit change. As many New Year's resolvers will agree, few experiences are as discouraging as repeatedly failing to keep a commitment to an important habit. The most important thing I'd learned during my study of how we change our habits? We can build our habits only on the foundation of our own nature. When I'd begun this inquiry, I understood very little about myself and my aptitude for habits. Now that I know I'm an upholder, an abstainer, a marathoner, a finisher, and a lark, and have spent a lot of time thinking about what is and isn't important to me, I'm much better able to shape my habits. By understanding myself better, I've also come to understand other people better. When I'd started my investigation, I felt quite confident doling out advice after a 5-minute conversation with a stranger, and I hadn't realized how much my suggestions reflected my own temperament. Now I'm much less dictatorial. The opposite of a profound truth is also true, and often opposing strategies work. We might try to make a habit more social, or more competitive, or more challenging, or less so. We might decide to go public with a new habit, or keep it private. We might abstain altogether, or indulge in moderation. No simple, universal solutions exist. What's more, if we don't consider these differences among individuals, it's easy to misunderstand whether and why a habit formation strategy is effective. A friend told me, "For good health habits, the key is to have confidence in your doctor. My mother did home dialysis for years, and people were amazed that she could do that. But she had so much confidence in her doctor." I had a different theory. "Let me ask you," I ventured, "would you describe your mother as a disciplined person?" My friend smiled in recognition. "Oh, yes." "Say, if you'd told her you needed to bring a signed note to school next Friday, she'd remember?" "Every time," she said. "Did she also take time for things that were important to her, not just to other people?" My friend nodded. "Maybe your mother was the kind of person who could follow through with something difficult like home dialysis. Maybe that was the key, not the confidence in her doctor." "Well," my friend admitted, "maybe so." When we clearly understand the various levers, both internal and external, that move habits, we can make change much more effectively. In my investigation of habits, I'd focused on the individual. The only person we can change is ourselves, and how we command ourselves is always the question that most interests me. Nevertheless, As I wrapped up my catalog of habit formation strategies, I became increasingly interested by the possibilities for change on a larger scale, how companies, organizations, institutions, and designers of devices and other products can use habit insights to shape people's habits. For instance, I spoke at a prominent tech company and afterward got a tour. In current corporate fashion, there was a big bowl of candy by the reception desk, a display of energy bars and juices near the doors, heavily stocked kitchens throughout the buildings, and a giant cafeteria. And everything free. "Let me ask you," I said to my guide, "do people gain weight when they start working here?" "Oh yeah," he said, "we all talk about it." In law school, we took issue spotter exams, which were actually kind of fun. An issue spotter exam presents a long tale of legal woe, and students must spot every issue that arises. The law school version of a child's find the hidden pictures puzzle. As I was shown around the corporate campus, I amused myself by trying to spot every change I'd make to help people foster healthier habits. What steps would make it easier for employees to eat more healthfully without even thinking about it? First, at the reception desk, I'd put all the candy in an opaque container with a lid, with a small sign that said, "Candy." I'd put doors on the office kitchens. I'd change the bins that stored candies and nuts, so instead of pouring out their contents in a stream, the bins would dispense one small serving at a time. Or better, I'd put those items in small, prepackaged baggies. By the end of my tour, I'd written a 10-point memo in my head. If this company changed the food environment at work, it could make a big difference in its employees' habits. But the fact is, for everyone, it's almost always easier, cheaper, and more fun to offer chocolate-covered pretzels than cucumber slices. And that's a challenge. I loved my new habits. To commemorate my new way of eating, Jamie gave me a Christmas ornament in the shape of a strip of bacon. But the habits that give me the most satisfaction are the habits I've helped other people to form. My father loves his new way of eating. He now weighs what he weighed when he played high school football. His statin and blood pressure medications were cut in half. And what's more, his doctor has started eating low carb. Eliza loves, well, maybe loves is the wrong word, finishing a big pile of homework on Sunday mornings. Elizabeth loves her habit of walking at her treadmill desk. When I checked in with her, she said, "My A1C level is great. I'm at the high end of normal." "Is that good?" I asked. "Yes. Sometimes I've been nowhere near the normal range, so that's a relief." "What's working?" I said. "I think it's a lot of things. The treadmill desk, for sure. Losing weight and cutting out a lot of crap that I was eating. The weekly strength training. It all feeds into each other. Also," she added, "Adam has been working out more, too." Habits multiply, for better or worse, within individuals. They also spread from one person to another. As Maria observed about cutting down on alcohol, "It starts to be self-reinforcing. When I drink more wine than usual, I feel like, ugh." Elizabeth's habit of exercise helped her to exercise more and helped her husband to exercise, too. On the other hand, the less we do, the less we feel like doing. If my office is a wreck, I don't feel like cleaning up. As I reflected on the changes I'd seen in my habits and in other people's habits, it struck me that only rarely do we achieve a dramatic, picture-perfect before and after. Sometimes we do make a complete transformation. It's not an utter fantasy. But usually we end up in a place that's better than before. And that's enough. Some habits become completely automatic. Others require some effort always. What matters is to be moving in the right direction. There's a great satisfaction in knowing that we've made good use of our days, that we've lived up to our expectations of ourselves. The true aim is not to break bad habits, but to outgrow them. With a bright light of attention, we can recognize and acknowledge them and leave them behind. Often, when we try repeatedly to form a habit that we desire, we fail because we want to reap its benefits without paying the price it demands. I think constantly of that stark line from John Gardner, so significant for habits, when he observed, "Every time you break the law, you pay. And every time you obey the law, you pay. Keeping a good habit costs us. It may cost time, energy, and money, and it may mean foregoing pleasures and opportunities. But not keeping a good habit also has its cost. So which cost do we want to pay? What will make our lives happier in the long run? Around the time that I completed my habit formation framework, I had a brief conversation with Eleanor that reminded me why I'd bothered with this long inquiry in the first place. Every Sunday, we have family movie night. One evening, I chose Lost Horizons, though I worried Eleanor might be a little bored or confused by the 1937 movie's story of a man who's spirited away to Shangri-La, a mysterious idyllic village hidden deep in the Himalayas. To my surprise, she loved it. So much, in fact, that after I showed her my copy of the novel, she was inspired to write a sequel. She labored away in a notebook, then came to read me what she'd written. I enjoyed her account of the romantic engagement and wedding of Robert and Sandra, but she really caught my attention after she'd finished. "Oh," she said, "I forgot to tell you the title of my book." "What?" I asked. She paused for effect, then said, "Everyday Life in Utopia." What a phrase. What an idea. Everyday life in Utopia. Eleanor, I told her truthfully, I absolutely love that title. That is genius. I couldn't get those words out of my head. I wanted to buy a t-shirt with that slogan printed on it. I wanted to tattoo it across my ankle. I wanted to paint it on the wall in my office. It struck me, in fact, that all of my work on habits and happiness was meant to help us construct, as much as possible, just that. Everyday life in Utopia. Everyday life with deep, loving relationships and productive, satisfying work. Everyday life with energy, health, and productivity. Everyday life with fun, enthusiasm, and engagement, with as little regret, guilt, or anger as possible. My study of habits has made me less judgmental, but also more opinionated, more convinced than ever of the enormous value of good habits. Before I started, I hadn't been making the most of my opportunities to create the life I wanted. Now, all that I'd learned about habits was helping me to make my life better than before, and step by step, to make my life more nearly my utopia. Tomorrow, without making any decisions, without exerting any willpower, I'll wake up at 6 a.m., kiss Jamie while he's still asleep, work on the computer for an hour, wake Eliza and Eleanor, fix the family breakfast, I'll have 3 scrambled eggs, no oatmeal, stand on one leg in the elevator, walk Eleanor to school, sit down at my clutter-free desk again, and so on. Those habits wouldn't make everyone happy, but they make me very happy. Everyday life in Utopia. Quiz. The 4 tendencies. Are you an upholder, a questioner, a rebel, or an obliger? Take this quiz. Make a note of every statement that describes you. By design, the 4 tendencies overlap, so you'll see yourself in more than one category. If you're like most people, you'll find that one category will more accurately describe your attitudes. This quiz isn't dispositive. It's just meant to help you get a clearer reading on yourself. Think about the tendencies and figure out the one that best describes you. Upholder tendency. I feel uncomfortable if I'm with someone who's breaking a rule, using a cell phone when a sign reads, "No cell phones," even if that person isn't going to get in trouble and isn't bothering anyone else. I can meet a self-imposed deadline, even one that's set somewhat arbitrarily. I've made New Year's resolutions in the past, and I usually have good success in keeping them. Note, this question is specifically about New Year's resolutions. It's just as important to keep my promises to myself as it is to keep my promises to other people. Other people sometimes feel annoyed by my level of discipline. I've been accused of being rigid. questioner tendency. If I want to make a change in my life, I'll make it right away. I won't make a New Year's resolution because January 1st is a meaningless date. It's very important for me to make well